The National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain at the Proms this Sunday evening. Vasily Petrenko conducting the world premiere of Frieze by Mark Antony Turnage. Frieze, as in those friezes by Gustav Klimt, painted on the walls of the Vienna Secession Building in 1902, inspired by Beethoven 9. Mark Antony Turnage showing his respect for the mighty symphony, which we will hear in the second half of tonight's programme. Vasily Petrenko gingerly makes his way back to the centre of the stage, because the stage is absolutely packed, as you might imagine. The Bull Run pretty much blocked by the first three of the double basses. There are 150 players, more than 150 players on stage this evening. 21st violins alone. And having brought the percussionists and then the brass players up, now the whole National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain rises to its feet. And Vasily Petrenko gestures to his right as Mark Antony Turnage sprints down the steps to the Royal Albert Hall stage, to smiles and much clapping from the NYO's players. Dedicated Frieze to his teacher and mentor, Oliver Nussen, who he says didn't like Beethoven in his youth, but is now liking his music more and more. Mark Antony Turnage now clapping the orchestra himself. Work commissioned by the BBC with the Royal Philharmonic Society and the New York Philharmonic. It'll get its US premiere in October. New York Phil will play it as part of a festival at Lincoln Center celebrating the bicentenary of the Royal Philharmonic Society, which is what we are doing this evening. Beethoven's bust on stage. Well, as has become something of a tradition at these NYO concerts, lots of former National Youth Orchestra members here this evening supporting a new generation of talented teenage musicians. Georgia Mann will be catching up with some of those alumni later on. First, though, in the 25 minutes or so before we hear Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, tonight's Proms Plus, recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music. I chaired a discussion embracing the history of Beethoven 9, the role it's taken, the revolutionary hymn to man's freedom, the style, the sound, the shape of the work, and the links it has with Great Britain, those links in part because of the RPS. My guests were Professor Amanda Glowett of the Royal College of Music and the journalist and writer Helen Wallace, who's done much research into the history of the Royal Philharmonic Society. Helen Wallace, Manchester Street, 17 Manchester Street, one cold winter's night 200 years ago was where it all began. Why did people gather there to form a new musical society?
Well, interestingly, although London had been a centre of very important orchestral music, if we think of Haydn's London symphonies at the end of the 18th century, by 1813, there was no permanent orchestra in London, and there were some very aristocratic series that were quite a closed shop, where Handel and that sort of music was considered still contemporary. And there was also a great love of concerts that included what we would call pasticcios, of endless vocal duets and virtuosic pieces and single movements. And some very enterprising musicians, because London was actually full of European musicians at the time, they got together to set up a serious orchestra where they would promote serious contemporary orchestral music, which had actually not had a platform for a decade or so. There were people like Kramer, Clementi, Viotti, Spagnoletti, and these were really the musicians at the top of their game and European virtuosi themselves, along with some English musicians who we may not, names not so familiar now, like William Ayrton and Charles Neate.
So this group are going to raise money to support performances, they're going to commission works. Were they straight away interested in new music?
Straight away, they were very interested in bringing over the top European musicians to London, commissioning new works. I mean, some of the earliest were by Cherubini and Louis Spohr. Straight away, they were interested in giving UK premieres of important works. So already there was Beethoven's Fifth Symphony was given in a very early season, and First Piano Concerto. And straight away, they gathered around them a body of people who were music lovers. They could come from any rank in society, and that was important because it wasn't a closed association. Aristocratic rank didn't come into it. There were a lot of people who they were subscribers, and when we think about it, the halls that they played in were not very big. So, in fact, the subscription base had to be fairly small. It was only about 300 initially. And they all put money into it. And that money was used initially to commission new works and continued to be.
So how famous was Beethoven in Britain at this point? How well known would he have been to music lovers?
He was very much recognised. I mean, we're talking 1813, so Fidelio had been performed. And, of course, connections between Vienna and London were not intense, but he was already very, very famous. And particularly among musicians, I mean, and this is who we're talking about, these people were very keen to hear all his symphonies. And, in fact, they tried initially to commission his Seventh Symphony, and they got there too late because he'd already written it.
So how did you go about in those days commissioning a new work? There weren't agents. Obviously, communication was pretty complicated.
Well, they started off by actually sending an envoy from the Philharmonic Society, as it was then called. They sent an envoy to Vienna, directly to Beethoven, to ask. And the initial journey that was undertaken by Charles Neate, he went to Vienna and asked for some pieces. And he was given by Beethoven three overtures, none of which was a great work of music. And it cost them pretty dear. I think there were 75 guineas for these three overtures. And he brought them back to the society and they said, we're not going to play any of these. Then the second time they sent a letter saying, could he write a symphony for them? And they were offering him 300 guineas for two symphonies at that time. And they heard nothing. But they weren't put off, they kept trying, and eventually they did commission the Ninth Symphony for £50, on condition that he came to London to conduct it. That was part of the fee, which that part of it didn't happen, but he eventually did send this symphony, which of course had already been performed in Vienna. And he very much led them to believe that he did write the Ninth Symphony for them and sent them a manuscript with the dedication to them. Of course, it had been published with the dedication to the Archduke Rudolf already.
Do you think he ever had any intention to come to London? Because they seem to really expect that would happen at some point, regardless yes. of the fact that his health by this point was terrible. He hated travelling, and certainly he didn't seem to have much intention of leaving Vienna for a trip to London.
Yes, there seemed to be boundless optimism. And initially, George Smart, who was the conductor of the first performance, he did actually say, look, let's just not play this, let's wait for Beethoven to come. We've offered him another £100, he'll come.
When did they eventually perform it?
Well, because it was what we might call an audience development program they had running, one of the things they did, which is was very innovative, is they used to have open rehearsals. They would call them trials of any new piece of music, and they would invite members of the society to come and hear the rehearsal. And in February 1825, they eventually rehearsed it. And the press did infiltrate this, and word went out that that this work was really going to be disastrous. They hadn't fully rehearsed the chorus with the soloists, with the, you know, the actual amount of resources needed meant that they had to piece it together. But there was such pressure, now that they'd got the glory of the score, that they decided in about 5 weeks later they did do a performance.
Do we know how it was received?
I think it was received with some foresight by a lot of critics, that they recognised its power, they recognised the originality. I think there was a sense in which people felt that, which is something Amanda may talk about later, that the final chorus movement was a mistake. And certainly a lot of the critics would say things like, you know, the expense and the rehearsals and the resources needed for this means it will never be performed again. And others said, however much you try to look at it, the last movement doesn't fit with the first. And we might as well play it just as the first three movements should be played separately. And in fact, that's 1825. It wasn't played again until 1837, which is extraordinary. Mm.
That's amazing, isn't it? When you think that it's now played in the proms every year, it gets performed, you know, as one of the great works that you know, gets endless outings. You might also think that was a sort of situation that was unique to London, but not so, Amanda, because the premiere in Vienna was equally chaotic, wasn't it, with Beethoven himself conducting?
Well, I think it's this thing, what we mean by conducting. There seems to have been three different musicians calling themselves leader or director, and one of them, Schuppanzig on the violin, was clearly waving his bow around in a sense of despair at various points, and there are accounts of the violins just dropping out and not playing whole passages. There was a very sort of long-suffering man called Umlauf, who I think was probably sitting with the keyboard, whispering to everybody, well, probably not having to whisper, because after all, poor Beethoven was very deaf, please ignore him, because at the side was Beethoven gesturing around wildly. And I think, this won't surprise you, there were whole passages of the last movement where the chorus gave up. And apparently there was pleadings from the, you know, the choral directors, the people who were training the choir, please, can you put it down, Herr Beethoven? Can you just drop, you know, take it down a third, please? And he refused to change anything.
Yes, he wasn't having any of this. As far as he was concerned, what was written down on paper, although, of course, quite how accurate their parts would have been is another matter. That was what they were going to do, and take it or leave it.
Absolutely. And I think that this sense of the sort of, you know, uncompromising nature. I mean, if you're going to put Schiller's Ode to Joy on the end, which had, you know, if we're talking about baggage and setting up something that's going to set, you know, a cultural kind of tone, I mean, I think for London, you know, the Beethoven 9 very soon became this kind of icon, didn't it, of a certain kind of cultural capital. Well, I think from the start in Vienna, it had that kind of baggage with it.
Let's talk a little bit about the shape of the work, and I know you want to focus particularly on the first movement and then the finale. You suggest that Beethoven saw it as being a sort of personal communal journey, this idea of darkness to light, but absolutely pushed to the limit.
Well, I think the idea of a symphony was often that it was meant to be something that was a kind of confessional ode, something that the composer was offering, that the audience would kind of join in and have a sense of a sort of celebration, of a sort of communal spirit. And I think the thing that was so challenging about Beethoven 9 is that when it starts, it is so mysterious. And what exactly you're supposed to be humming along to or tapping along to, you know, they, of course, people would be used to mysterious slow introductions. But the whole of the first movement is like one, you know, expanded mystery, really, just when we think things are beginning, you know, we come in with this rustling coming out of silence. The ex nihilo moment, which, if you like, Bruckner copied in every symphony he wrote, and Mahler, Wagner, all hugely influenced by it. Wagner said, this isn't melody, this is melos, this is almost like a primeval pre-melody. It's kind of elements, and you, the players, you, the listener, have to make your own kind of melodic sense out of this. Cosmic's the word that's often used. So.
Well, let's hear a little, an extract. We're going to hear the first 35 bars, I think, of the opening of the symphony. There is, it's extraordinary, the sort of the shimmer, isn't it, as the themes emerge.
And I think, in a way, we're talking about a music made of texture. And one of the things I love thinking about is how this journey that we talked about as we go through the symphony, I think the first movement's all about shimmer and texture and sounds coming out and dissolving again. This is very simplistic, obviously. I think the second movement is where we have rhythm and a kind of rhythmic momentum driven by the timpani, with a yump-a-bomb, which is sort of the focus, obsessively, of the whole movement. And then comes melody in the third movement, that glorious andante, the second tune. It's the first time I think we have anything we really feel we can sing along to, which is almost like a lullaby. And I will resist singing it, but you'll all hear it tonight. But listen out for that second. The first melody is completely magical, but the second one is one you start feeling you can actually hum along to, and which is the nearest to what we're going to get in the finale. Now, of course, the thing about the finale is we have the tune to end all tunes. And in fact, I think we could even refer to it as a ditty, a hymn, a nursery rhyme. I mean, something that's so sort of popular, it's so in your head, that you can't get it out. So having grappled up to this point to try and remember and to try and keep along with Beethoven, and suddenly we've now got this thing on a plate, which is embarrassingly familiar to most of us. And even if you haven't heard it before, it feels familiar within about 2 seconds because it's so full of repetitions. It goes round and round in circles.
And it's a very straightforward process, isn't it? The means it sticks in our minds.
Yes, yes.
Explain it.
Well, I think what he's done very cleverly, it's a sort of, it's a melody made up of A, B, B, just to sound slightly technical for a moment. So we go, that's A. That's B, then. Where am I? Oh, hang on. Oh, back to the beginning. And if you listen to it tonight, you notice you're never quite sure where you are. It's not simply A, B, A, oh yes, back to the beginning again. We go A, B, B, A, B, B. And it could, in a sense, go on forever. It's got this incredible generative momentum. And I love to think, but that's when I said about this idea of stretching the journey. It's like this idea of taking us somewhere very familiar, but projected. And I think that's why we have to have all this strange stuff at the beginning of the movement. Because before we get our lovely simple tune, of course, we've got all this, what I call shadow play, of this sort of scream from the orchestra, and then this sort of wandering recitative for the cellos and the double basses, which they couldn't begin to play in London, and I'm not sure that it always goes so well, even these days, with these sort of fragmentary sort of searching for how is this music going to continue, and we get bits from earlier movements brought in. And it's like he is theatrically presenting to us a sort of question of where can this journey end? And then here's one he's produced earlier. Then I'm going to give you a very, very simple ditty. And it takes probably about 2/3 of the way through the movement before we really believe that this is going to work.
Where do you stand on its relationship with the rest of the symphony? Because there are lots of people who feel very strongly that it does sort of spoil what comes before it, and I mean, Vaughan Williams took that.
Well, I think, you know, I'm one of these people that, and, you know, I mock myself for it, but I'm one of these people who likes the fact that Beethoven isn't just about music. It's also ideas about music. He's the kind of person who's projecting a journey not just through the notes, but also through the aesthetics of what a symphony can be. And I think if you take that leap with him, and if you go with that notion that, okay, I'm trying to teach you all to listen in a new way. Let's face it, I'm a deaf man. You know, I'm coming to the end of sort of communication now. I'm trying everything, and I'm going to give you a new way into music. And I'm going to start here with texture, and I'm going to take you through, you know, this journey with, I said, the rhythmic obsession of the scherzo, and then this magical, sublime melody. And I'm now going to take you into. If you think of it like that, then I think the last movement makes sense, because it's a kind of type. We've gone through types of musical experience, and now we're going to have the one that can pull it all together.
And in terms of the last movement, how open can we be to it now? Now it's become such an appropriated piece of music, you know, used as everything from the European Union anthem to the theme music of the United German Olympic team in the 1950s, the national anthem of UDI Rhodesia in the 1970s, the music that was played when the Berlin Wall came down. It's become bigger than itself, hasn't it?
But I think it was like that for Beethoven, because he was quoting himself, and the poem was one he'd been trying to set from the 1790s. The poem was terribly familiar. It had that, as I said, it had that kind of baggage. All this thing about, you know, was it an ode to Freiheit, to freedom, or to Freud, you know, to joy? I think Beethoven's given us ways of ironizing this, of making it. He is saying, yes, this is going to be very familiar. So although you might say we've got layers and layers and layers more that's been added, it always was a bit like that, I think, from the start.
And the Royal Philharmonic Society, Helen, latched into this kind of extra side to the work, didn't they? I mean, they decided that Beethoven was going to be their man and set out to make him the arbiter of all that was great about music here.
Absolutely, because, I mean, the commission and everything came in the very early years of the society, and they went on to commission the Italian Symphony and all sorts of other works, but in a sense, that became the iconic work, the most important thing they'd ever done. And 100 years after Beethoven's birth, they were offered a bust from a patron in Vienna, and this was with great ceremony. It was collected, it was brought back to London, and then at every concert that they used to promote concert series, and every single concert, they would put the bust there, rather as we do with Henry Wood at the Proms. But he came to stand for what they stood for, which was serious orchestral music, and also the highest culture and the highest excellence, and an internationalism that was very important that they brought to London, that they espoused. So when later that bust became made into the medal that even today the RPS award to musicians that they feel have really achieved something enduring and have a lasting legacy, the Beethoven medal is the symbol of that.
And that bust will be right next to the conductor on the Royal Albert Hall stage this evening. Helen Wallace and Amanda Glowett, thank you very much.
Tonight's Proms Plus was produced by Juan Carlos Jaramillo. Welcome back live to the Royal Albert Hall. Yes, Beethoven's bust gazing rather imperiously over the Prommers as they make their charitable announcement. We're just about 5 or 6 minutes away from Beethoven 9. Two changes of soloists tonight, Eilish Tynan and Toby Spence joining Jennifer Johnston and Gerald Finlay and the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, along with young singers from across Britain and Ireland. The National Youth Choirs of Great Britain, the Irish Youth Chamber Choir and Codetta from Derry Londonderry, this year's UK Capital of Culture. Earlier I caught up with three of the Irish singers, first Gemma Doherty and Gráinne Logue from Codetta.
Codetta is a chamber choir from City of Derry in Northern Ireland, set up in 2000. Our conductor, Donald Doherty, set up the choir coming from the youth choirs in the city. When some of the members got a bit older and came out of school, they just wanted to keep singing just for the love of the singing. And it's just, there's such a nice vibe in the choir. It's almost like a family. Like, everyone's just like best friends. And especially this year, we've just been pretty much together the whole year with the City of Culture. We've had so many fabulous opportunities.
It is Derry-based, but there are a lot of people studying or working away from Derry, so we rehearse about once a month or like every 3 weeks or so, so everybody comes back for these pretty intense like weekend rehearsals. And like for me, I'm studying away in Dublin, so it's really nice to have that connection at home and know that I can still go back home and like start performing and being involved, especially in, as Gemma said, like all the City of Culture events.
The city's just absolutely buzzing. It's so lovely.
Well, I'll say with us is Danny Fox, who is representing the Irish Youth Chamber Choir. Tell us a bit about its history.
Well, under the baton of Greg Beardsall, we were chosen from the bigger group, the Irish Youth Choir, which happens every year in Limerick. We have a summer course. And from that, Greg chooses the best of the best, and we put together a lovely chamber group. And we've been on the road since 2012, and it's been absolutely fantastic. We've had great opportunities to work with many different groups. We've actually performed at Electric Picnic, and then as well something a little bit different with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, as well as doing our own concerts and touring every year. So we've got quite a varied repertoire. We're between 25 and 30 young singers gathered together, and similar to Codetta, we're from different parts of the country, so it is lovely on weekends to meet up and rehearse and to see our friends again and just perform some great music.
Danny Fox from the Irish Youth Chamber Choir with Gemma Doherty and Gráinne Loge from Codetta. They are already in position on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. The first players of the NYO now coming onto the platform to take their position. Packed Royal Albert Hall. It's a free prom this evening. There's been a free prom for the past couple of years, but never before a main evening concert. So lots of people taking advantage of a great value night tonight, including former members of the National Youth Orchestra here to cheer on a new generation. Proms reporter Georgia Mann, I think, has some of them with her in the auditorium. Hi, Georgia.
Hi, Petrock. Yes, I am in the very heart of the action on the arena floor. Prommers shoulder to shoulder and moving slowly forward. With me, Elizabeth, Alice and Chris, who all were in the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. Elizabeth playing harp, Alice violinist and Chris tuba, principal tuba no less, for two whole years. Guys, first of all, this must be bringing back memories of your first time. Some of these players tonight will be playing for the first time in the Royal Albert Hall at the Proms. What were those first impressions like for you?
I can remember that my first Proms concert was Semyon Bychkov with Symphony Fantastique, and it was absolutely terrifying walking in because there were so many people. But the atmosphere is just so lovely in the Proms. It's everybody just kind of is really happy to be there. Everybody's here because they want to be there, and it was just a fantastic experience. All your nerves go away.
In a blink of an eye. Ladies, was it the same for you? Was it kind of astounding at first, but then brilliant, or yeah, just terrifying all the way through?
Absolutely, yeah. I remember the first concert very clearly, definitely one of the highlights of my teenage years, I suppose, and just feeling so lucky to be part of such a great festival.
There's a massive buzz backstage as well, and then sort of when you come on, it's quite intimidating, the audience, but after a while you just forget about it.
And there is a buzz backstage because this is the surely the most energetic, boisterous, noisy orchestra ever to have backstage. It's been brilliant bumping into them all backstage. What was the National Youth Orchestra experience like for you, not just musically, but as a wider life event for you all?
I think it was amazing sort of playing with people who are all just as enthusiastic as yourself, really passionate and wanting to just do the best they can as much as everyone else.
And there are just so many interesting individuals, I think, in the orchestra. Not everyone goes on to be musicians. People study lots of different things. And you really meet people that you'll keep bumping into for years and years to come. And I continuously meet people that I did concerts with and met in my time in the NYO.
Speaking of which, Chris, aren't you tackling medicine now?
Yeah, I'm doing medicine at UCL at the moment, which is it's a nice change from music. I still try and do as much music as I can. But it's nice, you know, being able to socialise with people that enjoy music as much as you and are just able to talk about it in the way that you want to, which you often don't get a chance to if you don't go to a music school.
And ladies, why did you come back this evening? Because it is a bit of a tradition to come along and cheer on the new troops. I mean, what made you decide to come back tonight?
Because we love it and we miss it.
What better reason could there be? Petrock, back to you.
Georgia, thank you very much indeed. Georgia Mann, who I could see a couple of minutes ago in the arena, but she's now been completely surrounded by Prommers, packing the space out, including those former members of the National Youth Orchestra. Let's hear from two of today's members, Welsh violinist Lily Whitehurst and Scottish clarinetist Michael Devlin. They are hugely enjoying the orchestra's relationship with chief conductor Vasily Petrenko.
he has really intense rehearsals, but he's also so much fun.
Yeah,
so.
We've noticed, we were just saying this, over the past 4 years maybe that we've been in the orchestra, that each year he's getting more relaxed, I think, working with the young people and cracking some jokes, which are really funny.
Which are hilarious. Yeah.
And what about the process of putting together Beethoven 9, this mega work?
Well, it's very different to anything the orchestra's ever done before. I mean, we've never tackled Beethoven as an orchestra, and it's been a challenge, hasn't it?
Definitely. In the sectional rehearsals and stuff, it's just a, like, style that NYO aren't used to playing.
The Beethoven, you have to be so precise, and everything has got to be so perfect, there's no room for error at all. So we've really had to be really disciplined in our rehearsal methods.
And it's like chamber music as well. There's so many bits in the woodwind, for example, where you need to have such a smaller feel to it than, say, like a Shostakovich symphony.
Yeah, we've done a lot of rehearsals actually without the conductor, so we just play as a chamber group to try and listen and contact everyone in the orchestra, and it's been really good fun to do.
But I think it's great to have massive forces playing Beethoven, and it's something that is just really different and will have different energy.
Hopefully brought a youthful spin to it.
It was Lily Whitehurst and Michael Devlin, both of them in their final appearance with the National Youth Orchestra. Both 18, both leave the season. Actually, Michael's 19 now. He's at university doing accountancy. Lily is going to carry on studying music. So four soloists in Beethoven 9, they will come onto the platform after the second movement. Eilish Tynan, Jennifer Johnston, Toby Spence and Gerald Finley. Behind the orchestra are trio of choirs, singers from the Irish Youth Chamber Choir, Codetta from Derry and the National Youth Choirs of Great Britain, and with them 150 plus members of the National Youth Orchestra. Silence falls in the Royal Albert Hall as we prepare for this great annual experience. Beethoven 9 combined tonight with the annual visit from the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. Vasily Petrenko makes his way onto the platform. The vast forces in front of us rise to their feet. Beethoven continues to gaze out. Beethoven Symphony No. 9 in D minor, the Choral Symphony.